This is Car Expert.
Toyota's launching a car that's going to be so popular. Why would they not try and make as much money as possible out of it to start with?
No idea what impact it'll have on the sales charts, but as a brand builder and an image builder for Land Rover, it's absolutely crucial.
What really surprised me about the MUX was how roomy it is. I mean, this is an utterly enormous vehicle inside.
Hello, I'm Mandy Turner, and hello to Albor's fella.
Hello, Mandy, how are you?
Very good. Good to have you on the panel this week. And also good to have Scott Colley. Hello.
Hello, guys. Nice to see Albor's face on the panel. I think this is the first time we've been together on the podcast.
Oh, look, you know, when it's lockdown, if I have a reason to stay in the office and not go home, it's essential that I do.
Some really cool news for Car Expert that broke, was it maybe just today, I was on the Thursday. We're up for some awards.
Absolutely. So we are nominated for 4 awards for Mumbrella Publish Awards. And for a lot of you guys that listen, you probably don't know what that is, but that's kind of like the Oscars of publishing in Australia. It's the sort of way I would describe it. And we got nominated for 3 amazing awards, Website of the Year, which is the main one. It's like, you know, the film of the year sort of thing. Launch of the Year, which is amazing, and also Event of the Year, which is for our Experience Center in Sydney. So we're really hopeful of hopefully winning a few of those. We also unfortunately got nominated for Editor of the Year for Paul Merrick, but I'm currently doing my very best to make sure he doesn't win that award because I could not deal with his signature carrying that for the next God knows how long. So
that's definitely one of those ones that he needs to get up there and go, I'd like to thank the whole editorial team. This one really goes out to you. And we'll all know that means thank you all for doing this for me. And I'll just claim it.
For someone who's never edited or managed, the Editor of the Year award will be fantastic for him.
So when did we find out the winners?
On my birthday, 9th of September.
Oh, so meant to be.
I hope so. I want to win at least one and not the bloody Editor of the Year award. So otherwise, I'm going to just change my title to editor.
Website of the Year would be a very nice award to win.
Yeah, Launch of the Year as well.
Well, yeah, speaking of the Launch of the Year, any update on those experience centres?
Well, we were supposed to launch one basically in September, October for the next one in Sydney. However, given the current situation, that's obviously not going to happen. So, look, I think at the moment we're sort of thinking first quarter next year. It's a really shame because we had such a positive response to the first one. We had some amazing data and more than 30,000 people and almost 300 test drives. Really good stuff, but I guess we can't really control COVID. So what can you do? And we're hoping that Sydney and Melbourne are both out of it at some point and we can open up in both of those cities early next year. That's the current plan.
Yeah. You're lucky you got the time to do that in Sydney when you did. So, you know,
yeah,
honestly,
when we closed the doors at the end of June to reopen pretty shortly after in a couple of months, and that literally the following week Sydney went into lockdown. So
wow,
it was well timed for us to have done our trial. So it worked out well. But yeah, it's a bit annoying to have to wait now for so long. But again, like, I mean, there's so many businesses that are suffering much worse than us that I can't even really complain about.
Yeah, very, very true. Scully, you've had this entire 3 minutes we've been talking already, this massive cheeky grin on your face. What have you been driving?
I very briefly, just for a night, got to drive a Porsche 911 Turbo convertible. I've driven a couple of 911s of different generations, but never a turbo. And this one was in because Paul and James were doing some really cool drag race content with it. So you have to keep your eyes peeled for that because that's far more exciting than me just saying I drove it home and back to the office. But
does your head stick out? Like, do you actually sit outside of the car?
I don't actually. I was kind of nervous because a lot of really expensive stuff and two-door stuff, I just don't fit in. I've driven an Aventador, for example, and I drove that with a helmet on, with my helmet on the roof and my head at 45 degrees, and I could genuinely change gears with my knees. They were that high at the back of the steering wheel. So I was surprised I fit so well in the turbo, but I was so surprised by how comfortable and quiet it was. I was really, really impressed with it as a car just to drive to and from work in. But Paul, you and I have talked about this. I'm not sure that's what I want from my 911.
Yeah, look, I love the 911 Turbo S is the one I drove when they did the launch up here in Brisbane. I do really love it. I've always loved the car, but as I always make a joke, is I'm not old enough yet to own one. I kind of just it's such a great daily, but for that sort of 500 grand or a bit more actually now, it's a lot of money, hey, for a car that doesn't really scream the money. But a lot of people love that. A lot of people actually enjoy having a car that's got supercar capacity, and that certainly does, without all the drama that goes with it. I'm not one of those people, so for me its appeal is slightly limited. I would rather drive a base model Carrera as a daily than a 911 Turbo S, because then I could buy base model Carrera and probably a Vantage for the same money and actually have a bit of best of both worlds.
Mm. I think, Mandy, we've talked about this in the podcast before, and I still haven't driven one because they're not in Australia yet, but a GT3 Touring with a manual I still think is top of my 911 list. But
agreed.
Can't say I was anything less than blown away by how impressive the turbo is based on a very short drive.
That's so cool. Did it sound good with the top down?
It's not a sort of sexy noise.
The answer is no. Yeah. Really? Absolutely not. There's no good sound coming out of a 911 turbo. Shame.
It's a very industrial kind of sort of bassy, gruff noise from the engine, and there's turbo whistles and intake noises and that sort of thing, but it's not a sexy noise, no.
I'm disappointed. When you put the top down to the sports car, it's just, I know. Not even in sport mode or sport plus mode or whatever has gotten it. Nothing.
Does it have a particulate filter? It doesn't, does it yet? I don't think it does yet.
I don't know that it does in Australia, no.
Yeah. Well, like a lot of the new cars, like I drove an RS3 recently and it had a petrol particulate filter, and man, it had lost all its character. Like the RS3 used to be like loud and raspy and all sorts of things, but it's nothing like that anymore.
I think there's going to be a good industry of people who will, just like they'll put an Akrapovic exhaust on your Golf or your Audi at the moment, of people who will start rooting around and removing particulate filters and doing all sorts of things.
Well, you say that, but in the EU, the computers are actually designed to notice if the particulate filter is removed and go into limp mode for a lot of cars in anticipation of people doing exactly that. I know the F8 Tributo, the Ferrari, has a petrol particulate filter, and if you try and remove it, which I know a few people have, it actually stops the car from working. So then you need to reprogram the ECU to get around it, which is doable, but gee, that's a lot of effort.
Bloody hell. Incredible. All right, let's get into this week's news. Let's start with you, shall we, Scully? Mercedes-Benz has been taken to court for allegedly minimizing, I'm doing air quotations, a Takata risk.
It has. So the Australian Consumer and Competition Commission, or the ACCC, on Wednesday night launched a federal court action against Mercedes-Benz for minimising or downplaying the risks of Takata airbags. And what the ACCC is essentially saying is that people in Mercedes-Benz call centres who were talking to owners who were calling up with cars with beta Takata airbags in them, rather than saying the car couldn't be driven, it had to be towed back to the dealer, you should not get behind the wheel, said that it was okay or it was safe to drive the car up until the time the airbag was fixed, and that's a contravention of the mandatory government recall they announced, because the government rules said that you had to use attention-capturing, high-impact language about the recall, all of it with the goal of getting people to take their Takata airbags out and get them replaced for free, because the Takata airbags could kill you if they go off in an accident.
Can you just political correctness gone absolutely mad there?
So Mercedes-Benz has responded with a very straight statement saying that it's cooperating with the ACCC. It's also said, though, that the recall notice for its cars didn't require Mercedes-Benz owners to stop driving their vehicles. So the quote from Mercedes is, it does not understand how saying an owner could continue to drive their vehicle could be a breach of the recall notice. So it doesn't sound like Mercedes is going to take this lying down, especially given the ACCC is chasing money, it's chasing costs for the actual legal battle, and it's also chasing an order requiring a product recall compliance program, which is essentially the ACCC working with Merck and looking over its shoulder on how it does all its recalls going forward. It's quite an interesting one, because if you're Mercedes-Benz, there would be a cast of hundreds working in these call centres, and they would have taken thousands of calls about the Takata airbags. And the ACCC is alleging that on at least 73 occasions these problems occurred. So it's not as if there was an internal memo that went out saying, just tell people to be calm, but clearly someone at the call centre has said the wrong thing, and the ACCC has got a copy of that call or that email and is chasing them up about it.
As a Mercedes-Benz owner, I was harassed by the company for about 2 years to get my airbags replaced. And I can tell you, it was like that time when I was 19 and didn't return Donnie Darko to Civic Video, and they chased me Like every 5 minutes, it was a phone call, it was a letter in the mail, and it was all red. And I just thought, man, just leave me alone. Like, I'll do it when I want to. Just, but so for them, for someone to suggest that they weren't taking it seriously, my personal experience is very different. I actually felt like filing a harassment complaint against Mercedes.
Those are letters that you were getting, were they directly from Mercedes-Benz board?
Because I wanted them to promise that they would replace the airbag in the SLS without damaging the dash. And, of course, they weren't going to ever promise that. Mm. But it was getting down to the point where I think if I hadn't done it, then my car wouldn't be allowed for re-registration. So
yeah.
I had to bite the bullet and do it.
I got a letter in the mail only just a couple of days ago from Vic Roads in Victoria saying that my 2012 Volkswagen Up had potentially Takata airbags in it. And I've had that car for 18 months now. And it's the first I've had a letter. Oh,
better stop driving it and set it on fire or something, you know.
Letter said same thing, like red everywhere, exclamation marks. Oh my god!
You know what I liken this to, and I this is going to be controversial, but you know how I am. This is like the vaccine side effect of dying from AstraZeneca. Like the chances are so low that you would one have an accident and two have a faulty airbag. To stop telling people to drive their car is kind of like telling people to not take the vaccine because you could be one in whatever million to have that issue, right? It's literally the same thing, but for whatever reason, when it comes to the Takata airbags, we're like, stop driving the car, it's going to explode. But with the vaccine, it's like, no, you can keep taking it, it's fine. The chances are so low. So if someone can explain to me the difference between those two things, I'd really love to hear from you.
Spoken like a true Queenslander with a chief health officer who says, don't touch it.
Our chief health officer said yesterday, stop ordering things online so delivery drivers don't have to come around to your house. Oh. I was like, holy hell.
You can't go into shops. How else are you supposed to get stuff? Oh, God.
She's 190 years old, that lady.
That's up there with the Adelaide chief health officer who said, if the football comes into the crowd, don't touch it.
I saw that. Oh, good.
Anyway, we're miles off the rails here.
Oh, yes. Let's get back to cars.
We're probably
going to
get banned from podcasting because we mentioned the word.
Now, this is something that we've been waiting on for a very long time, the pricing and details for the 2022 Toyota Land Cruiser 300, Scully.
We have been. The Land Cruiser is always a massive deal. It's the biggest story in motoring, especially in Australia. And we've been waiting to know what it'll cost because we've seen Land Cruiser 200 series, the current or the outgoing model, prices jump from just over $100,000 a list to almost $200,000 on the secondhand market, which is crazy. You won't be paying that much for a new Land Cruiser 300, but it is more expensive. So the range kicks off with the GX at $89,990, and it runs all the way to $138,790 for the range-topping Sahara ZX. Wow. In between, there's six models in total. The most interesting one to me is the GR Sport, which has a whole lot of unique stuff on it that's supposedly been developed for Toyota's Land Cruiser Dakar Racer. In Australia, only one engine is going to be offered. It's going to be a 3.3-litre twin-turbo diesel V6, and it's got 227 kilowatts of power and 700 newton-metres of torque. So it's down 1.2 litres and two cylinders on the old Land Cruiser, but it's actually got 27 kilowatts and 50 newton-metres more, and it uses less than 9 litres per 100 k's on the combined cycle. So by every metric you can put on paper, it looks like it's going to be a better engine than the V8, but obviously we're going to need to drive it to know how that plays out in the real world. Even the base model comes with a whole lot of kit. It comes with a 5-seat interior, and all the mid-range models have 7 seats. But you get LED headlights, keyless entry and start, a 9-inch infotainment system, which is up on the 6-inch system in the current car, 6 cup holders, a reversing camera, so all the stuff you'd expect of a base model. The one that really interests me, and I think will interest all of the cashed-up Land Cruiser owners around Australia at the moment, is the Sahara ZX, which at close to $140,000 is nudging like serious V8 BMW X5 money, but it comes with things like illuminated tread plates, heated and ventilated seats for the first and second row, a hands-free tailgate, on top of all the other stuff that comes in lower models, like a much bigger 12.3-inch infotainment screen, a 7-inch digital trip computer, remote power windows, power adjustable steering wheel, all that stuff that you'd expect of a high-end Toyota. So it does come loaded. Whether or not it's $140,000 worth of car is going to come down to the driving, but we're very excited to get behind the wheel.
Mm. What do you think of the pricing, Boz?
Yeah, look, I don't know. Things are just getting expensive, aren't they, Scott? Like it's I feel like because used cars are so expensive, every time there's a new car coming out, people just, you know, put up the price because people will pay it.
Mm, especially Toyota product.
Yeah, yeah. But hey, I think maybe there's a bit of inflation going on in there as well. Cars have been so cheap for so long comparatively to everything else, and all of a sudden we seem to have this massive step change. So it is what it is.
We've actually got Mike working on at the moment a story about how prices of cars have risen in the past 5 years compared to CPI. So it's going to be really interesting to see those numbers borne out online. That should be going live in the next couple of weeks. I think also if you're launching a new car like the 300, if it's not more expensive, people might question why it's better. So you've almost got to sort of price it a little bit higher. Otherwise, people will be a little bit suspicious of everything else you're throwing in there. That might be miles off the mark. But if you're Toyota, you've got to prove to people that it's got a whole lot more stuff and it's higher tech. And one way to do that is by bumping up the price.
The small hatch market was always around at, you know, low 20s for many, many years. And now all of a sudden it's in the high 20s. But I think it's just a reflection of the fact that money isn't what it used to be. You know what I mean? And also that Toyota's launching a car that's going to be so popular. Why would they not try and make as much money as possible out of it to start with? Like, it's the beginning of a model cycle of a car that's going to be around for probably till I have grandkids at this point. That's how long that's how long those cars stick around. So you may as well make as much money out of it as possible at the beginning.
How old was the previous generation? Do you remember?
I think it was about 12 years. I can't remember exactly. Wow. Maybe even longer than that. I can look it up on the fly here. Hang on.
It's still not as old as the Pajero, is it? Like,
nor as old as the 70 series, which has its roots in horse and cart era.
Nice.
Oh, well, the Audi RS3 sedan has set a new Nürburgring lap record.
Yeah, it sure has. It set the fastest lap for a compact model at 7 minutes and 40 seconds, which is pretty incredible, actually. I was actually having a conversation about this car with somebody the other day, saying that, you know, 10 years ago, a sub-8-minute lap was supercar territory, and now you've got an RS3 doing it 20 seconds quicker than that. Although, to be fair, it's running Trofeo R tires, which are basically a super soft tire, and it's got carbon ceramic brakes. And if you told anybody that a compact hatch would have carbon ceramic brakes 10 years ago, they would, you know, fall off the floor laughing, because that's quite an expensive thing to have it's an expensive car, but it's not supercar money. But it's, you know, it's quicker than the RSQ8, which I know is a big SUV, but that's actually quite surprising for me, because this is just a 5-cylinder engine. I love the RS3. And that lap time is just ridiculous. I'd be very interested to see how much this is going to cost, because I reckon this is going to be bloody expensive.
Do we care really about these lap times anymore? I know that sounds a little bit harsh, but realistically, the RS3 is going to be driven down Chapel Street at 9 or 10 o'clock at night while people are eating outside in first gear. Difference does the Nürburgring time
Such
make?
Acidic. A lot of people are going to track the RS3, in my opinion, and I think that would probably have some reflection on them. My issue with the Nürburgring lap times are that they're almost impossible to verify in regards to their relation to the actual car. Like, you know, Lamborghini set the standard with the Performante a few years ago, where the lap time was so unbelievably fast and the video didn't really match what it said. And I think it's kind of a bit tainted now. Like, no one really believes it anyway. So that's why we do our own track comparisons, Scott, with an actual race car driver on the day, and then you'll see which one's faster. But I'd love to put this up against the A45 and see who wins.
Look forward to seeing what Atco can do behind the wheel.
Oh, yes, me too. And lastly, we've got all the details for the 2022 Hyundai Staria. I'd never thought I would say that this people mover actually looks quite good.
It's awesome. I love it.
It looks like a spaceship, doesn't it? It's really, really funky.
Yeah. I really want to buy one, even though I have absolutely no reason. But that's such a cool – I just want to drive around in it and, like, put massive wheels and, like, neons underneath it.
slam the hell out of it.
Yeah, how cool is the car? Like, it's so cool. I love it. I can't believe they actually released it. But the back of it doesn't match the front. So I'm really confused. It's a really bizarre rear. The rear looks like a semi-normal car, but the front looks like a spaceship.
The back end of it gives me Mitsubishi Nimbus vibes, which I realize is a weird reference, but someone at my primary school had one. Anyway, although it looks out of this world, it actually has a price that's pretty reasonable. It starts at $48,500 before on roads and runs to.
I'm going to just stop you. Anyone that says a people mover's price is reasonable at $50,000 has really well and truly caught on to the inflation of cars at the moment.
Well, you can still buy a cheaper people mover that's just an LDV G10, which is a van with some seats in it. But
it goes to $66,500 for the top spec. Now, who the hell would pay that for a people mover?
Well, if we're talking seats per dollar or dollars per seat.
It's not Aldi.
No, I do see what you're saying. But when you consider the list of standard equipment, the standard safety equipment, and the way that the interior of this thing looks, it does sort of fit more closely with a nice mid-range SUV or something like a nice Santa Fe. So based on that sort of pricing, I think it's pretty much in line. I do agree that I don't want to be spending more than I have to on a people mover, though. The interesting thing with the Staria is that it comes with all-wheel drive. It's built on the same platform as the Hyundai Santa Fe, also shares some bits and pieces with the Kia Carnival, even though it's much bigger than the Carnival. But the Carnival isn't available with all-wheel drive in Australia, and this is, which Hyundai says is quite a unique selling point. And when you look at the rivals that it's up against, you've got to pay $15,000 or $20,000 more for something with a German badge on the nose to get all-wheel drive in your people mover. So that's one of the big points of difference. The other one is the safety suite that comes with this car. Hyundai is giving you blind spot assist, lane keep assist, and lane follow, which is the first thing I turn off in any Hyundai car. It's very aggressive, but some people like it. Autonomous emergency braking, driver attention monitoring, a system that'll beep at you if the kids are trying to open the door into moving traffic, rear cross traffic assist, and a surround view monitor as standard. And then if you jump up to the Elite, which is the mid-spec model, it gets a system that'll actually stop you opening the door if cars or a cyclist are coming, and a 3D surround view camera that lets you pan around the car. So some features that we're starting to see in higher-end SUVs and top-end Kia and Hyundai stuff, but quite unique in the world of people movers.
Do you think that Hyundai just couldn't help themselves by making that safe exit assist a non-standard feature across the range? I kind of feel like they almost had it. They had all of it standard, and they just couldn't help themselves but make one of it not available on the base model. It really annoys me. I think safety should never be compromised, and that's such a cool feature that, especially for a people mover with full of kids, I reckon that should be standard across the range. I really do.
I totally agree with you, especially when some of the stuff that you get standard in the base model is really not essential. Things like wireless phone charging and paddle shifters on the wheel and that sort of thing.
Paddle shifters in a people mover. Oh, God.
If you want to get to school really quickly. I'd much rather they take some stuff like that out and put the safety kit in. I completely agree.
Yeah. Incredible. Well, if you have any thoughts, let us know, podcast@carexpert.com.au. G'day, Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy Turner. How are
you? Oh, great. Thank you. That time of the month again for VFacts, the new car sales figures for July has been released, and another record-breaking month, I see.
Indeed. Despite constantly hearing nothing but all semiconductor shortages causing havoc with suppliers and COVID shutdowns, causing mayhem across the economy, new car sales continued to grow, up 16.1% in July relative to the same month last year, to just over 84,000 units, which takes the year-to-date total to 26.5% up, although, of course, last year was a pretty bad year for everybody, to 651,629 units, which puts the market in its healthiest position since 2018. We saw really, really strong double-digit growth over the month from Victoria, Queensland and WA, which countered a drop-off in New South Wales. Actually, New South Wales only fell away 1.7%, which was surprising considering it was locked down for a lot of the month. I thought it would have fallen away by a little bit more than that. And quite naturally, the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries is delighted to see this result. To sum it up in short, Toyota, Mazda and Ford occupied the podium. Kia outsold its big brother Hyundai for the third successive month. Rugged-focused brands Isuzu, Ute and Land Rover posted particularly big gains, as did Chinese brands MG, GWM and LDV, on the back of them having really no interrupted supply lines.
Okay. Shall we cover off on the top brands?
Yes, indeed. So as always, Toyota number one, up 14%. Mazda in second, Ford in third, completing the top 10, Mitsubishi, Kia ahead of Hyundai in sixth, Volkswagen, Isuzu Ute, up 160% for the month following the launch of the new MUX and continued success from the D-Max Ute. MG in ninth. That Chinese brand is well and truly ensconced in the top 10 now, up 200%. Mercedes-Benz in 10th, just ahead of Nissan and Subaru. The really fast grower was GWM, which includes Great Wall Motor and Haval bundled into one, up 300% and in 13th position ahead of BMW and Suzuki, which is a pretty extraordinary rise for that particular brand.
Mm-hmm. Hilux still number one?
Hilux, as always, in number one place, just ahead of Ford Ranger. Isuzu D-Max in fourth place. So three of the top four were Utes. Corolla also made it onto the podium, the humble Toyota Corolla. Overall, from the top 20, there were six Utes, four mid-sized SUVs, three small SUVs, two large SUVs, one light car, and four small cars.
Moco, what about electric cars? It seems like there's been finally some growth in that part of the market recently. Did that keep going?
Yeah, we are starting to see some good growth here. So they hit new highs. Now, Tesla doesn't participate in VFACTS. It doesn't supply sales data. So while we get information from sources around what Tesla sales sort of roughly are, we don't know the exact figures, so we don't include them in these VFACTS wrap. But taking aside Tesla, which is the clear market leader, there were still 515 EVs sold for the month, which is up 273%, and plug-in hybrid sales hit 325 units, up 150%. Now, I was sent some data today from a friend of mine in the industry showing that the most popular EV, non-Tesla EV, I should say, is the MG ZS electric vehicle, which is far and away the top-selling non-Tesla EV, just ahead of the Porsche Taycan and Nissan Leaf. I should also mention on the EV front that this is the month that both Victoria and New South Wales introduced subsidies and tax breaks for electric vehicles to stimulate sales for affordable EVs. It also coincided with a price cut on the Model 3 Tesla. So the interest in EVs is growing, not just with more cars becoming available, but also a more friendly economic setup for them.
I'm interested to see how the German car brands went, considering the Chinese brands keep stepping over them each month.
Yeah, well, China is now our fourth biggest source of imports ahead of Germany. And that, of course, remained the case for the month of July. But if we look at the main German brands, Mercedes-Benz just scraped inside the top 10, but it was down nearly 10%. And that's including its vans division in there. BMW in 14th, up 80%. A fantastic result for BMW. Audi in 16th, up 4%, and doing really, really well. Obviously, you probably wouldn't include Skoda as a German brand, but it is owned by a German corporation, Volkswagen, and it was up 24%, 806 units as well. So a relatively strong month for the German metal, just not as strong as China. Scully?
Moco, what about a couple of old top 10 favourites, Honda, Nissan? How did they go last month? Because there's some changes going on there, obviously.
Yeah, there certainly are. So Nissan and Subaru finished just outside. Honda is a really interesting one. We know that Honda in July started its new business structure in Australia. Basically, rather than wholesaling its cars to its franchise dealers, it owns all the stock, uses dealers as handover partners, has fixed prices, so you pay what you pay. There's no such thing as haggling anymore. And as part of this, the company has trimmed back its model line and has openly said it plans on selling far fewer cars than it used to. It wants to downsize its operations in Australia. Now, whether that's just, you know, putting a good spin on the fact that it's, you know, losing interest, or whether it genuinely sees more profit and a stronger business to be had with smaller volumes is sort of up for debate. But nevertheless, the company said it's only going to sell 1,650 cars a month from here on in. Now, it fell well short of that for the month. It was about half of that. So it was a huge loss, and it was a long way down the list. In fact, if I'm scrolling down my list now, you can see that Honda is between Land Rover and Skoda. So that's a long way down the pecking order compared to where it used to be when it was ensconced inside the top 10. Now, the company, I actually spoke to some Honda staff during the week to sort of see what was going on there, and they said that they basically had no pullover orders or carryover orders from June. They started the entire new business model from scratch. It took them half a month just to get their systems operational, and they're expecting normal business to resume next month. So we'll be keeping a close eye on Honda in August, but it certainly wasn't a good July for that particular brand.
It's not a very good reflection of this new business model, though, is it? It's not a very good start to it. Maybe it's the times, maybe it's COVID, but yeah, it's not looking good for getting rid of all your dealers all at once.
No, well, Honda is copping quite a lot of grief from some of its former dealers. You know, it's always hard introducing a new business model and doing something different. We've seen cars sold in the same way for a long, long time, and Honda is one of those brands trying something new. And when you try something new, you're always going to attract criticism. And if it doesn't work, you're going to attract even more criticism. So I think the industry as a whole is going to be watching Honda really closely. I think the first month being no good, you could let slide, but you want to make sure that you're starting to see a bit more growth moving forwards. Just to wrap it up, I've got a little section at the bottom of my VFAX story called Miscellaneous, just running through a couple of facts and figures. SUVs, I really want to point out, 42,000 sales, well and truly more than light commercials and passenger cars combined. Light commercial vehicles were up 40% though, so utes and vans absolutely boomed during the month. 4x4 utes alone were 20% of the market. So 1 in 5 of all vehicles bought was a 4x4 ute. Private market was up 17%. The rental market was up 230%. Clearly, during COVID, there wasn't a hell of a lot of demand for rental cars. And now that, well, I say this just going into yet another lockdown, but theoretically, the rental companies are starting to, you know, get their fleets back in order again. Sales by country of origin, the top 5, Japan, Thailand, Korea, China, and Germany. And hybrid cars down 23%. So we spoke before about EVs on the up, plug-in hybrids on the up. Hybrid cars down by quite a bit, much of which is due to supply shortages on RAV4. But it's going to be really interesting to see as EVs and FEVs grow, what's going to happen to hybrid car sales as well.
Yeah. Well, that full VFAX report is at the website now if you want to have a full in-depth read of that. We might keep you on a little bit longer, Moko, because you've been driving the Isuzu MU-X. And as you mentioned in VFAX, Isuzu is kicking goals at the moment. Yourself and Alborz has driven the MU-X, so we can have a bit of a discussion about that. Before we get into your impressions of it, Moko, can you give us a quick rundown on the MU-X?
Yeah, so this is the second generation Isuzu MU-X. Obviously, the previous generation one became a smash hit in Australia. It was a hell of a lot cheaper than a Toyota Prado, and a lot of grey nomads and regional-based families or, you know, people who love to go 4x4 and really fell in love with it. It was a no-nonsense, tough machine that just did a job. And this new one, just like we saw with the new D-Max on which it's based, is a lot more sophisticated and upmarket than before. It's got all of the active safety features that are really available on the market now. It's got electric steering, not hydraulic. It's got a revised chassis, a more refined version of the signature 3-litre diesel engine, a heck of a lot more spec, a sportier new look, and price increases at least of up to $9,000, topping out at $63,990 drive away. So it's a more premium vehicle, but it's also more expensive than what came before it. And it's going to be really interesting to see how it competes against, well, not just the Mitsubishi Pajero Sport, which has always been a main rival for it, but of course the Ford Everest, and at a slightly higher echelon, the Toyota Prado. And the company's really repositioned it now to sort of sit pretty much alongside that Aussie-engineered Everest as a kind of mid-tier body-on-frame 4x4.
Awesome. Boaz, I'm keen to hear your first impressions of jumping into the MU-X.
Look, I've actually been driving it for what feels like a month now. I really like it. I know that sounds bizarre for someone that doesn't usually like those kinds of cars, but I've been really enjoying it. It's been my driving vehicle of choice for the last couple of weeks. I really like the interior. I'm actually quite surprised by how much punch it has out of that engine. The old one certainly didn't feel anything like that. And I know it's a revised motor, but geez, it's pretty punchy. My wife doesn't like it so much though, and she had a good drive of it. And it's mainly around its, I guess, still remaining agricultural feel, just in the way the doors close and how heavy they are and some other random things. Mine's a little bit buggy with its active cruise control not working very well. It's auto headlights not working very well, but I'm pretty sure that's just little glitches that can be fixed quickly. Overall, though, I really do actually like the car.
Yeah, I was super impressed. I actually took it for a long drive this week. I'm doing a comparison at the moment against the Prado. I thought the Prado was the best car to test it against because the Prado is far and away the most popular large body on frame 4x4 kicking around. And I actually was half a second quicker to 100 in the Isuzu than the Prado, even though on paper the Prado's got more power and more torque. So the Isuzu engine is just an honest engine. Six-speed gearbox has got four fuel ratios in the Ford Everest, but the Ford's gearbox is constantly hunting between ratios, whereas the Isuzu's just kind of surfs the torque band. You know, the towing capacity has been upped to 3.5 tons now, which is class leading, though if you are at payload, obviously the gross combined mass means that you can't tow that full amount at payload, but it's become a sort of consummate tow-based vehicle. Paul Marich took it off-roading for a video that will be live by the time this podcast goes to air, and I encourage you to go watch it because even with 20-inch wheels and highway tires on our luxury spec version, it just walked over all of the 4x4 challenges we threw at it, and now, unlike the old car, it's got a rear locking differential, which we were crying out before on the old vehicle, and Isuzu was finally listened. So this car is sort of very much doing what the old one did, but it's just a lot of those rough edges have been smoothed away. It's a more sophisticated machine. Yes, it costs more, but you kind of do get what you pay for.
So the new Isuzu D-Max, which is what the MUX is based on, was a really big step forward from the car it replaced, but it's still not quite as luxurious inside as, say, a Prado or even something like a top-end Ford Everest. Has Isuzu made many changes to the MUX interior compared to the D-Max to make it a bit more luxurious, and has it taken a big step forward there?
In short, it's very similar to the new D-Max for good and bad. It's got a 9-inch touchscreen on all by the base model, which is great, with wireless Apple CarPlay and good navigation. The seats are brilliant. They're like those old HSV seats. They're like lazy boy armchairs. They're super supportive and they're heated as well with electric adjust for the driver. The steering wheel telescopes now, unlike the old model, which is great. The build quality is pretty good, although the materials and trims used are certainly built to a price. It doesn't have that premium feel that the Prado does, and certainly not a monocoque crossover like a CX-9 offers. What really surprised me about the MUX was how roomy it is. I mean, this isn't utterly enormous vehicle inside. It's pretty much identical in size to the old one, but the second row, I'm nearly 2 meters tall, and I had tons of space in the second row with vents in the roof, USBs, big grab handles to pull yourself up. But the third row is genuinely useful. So the 60-40 split fold middle seat row, the big portion is on the passenger side. It's a tilt and tumble mechanism. So one lever flips that seat base up, and the aperture into the third row is sufficient for me to climb in, and I can actually fit in a third row. Now, not comfortably, but Mandy, I imagine you would be perfectly comfortable back there. And moreover, behind even a third seating row, there's still room for a suitcase and some duffel bags. So this is a truly spacious vehicle. It's actually much more capacious inside than a Prado and an Everest. Its seat folding is much cleverer than a Fortuna or a Pajero Sport, which are quite basic and agricultural in terms of practicality. So huge strides have been made there. Probably the biggest grievances I had are the overabundance of glossy black piano black trims that just a magnet for sun reflections and dust and things like that. The angle of the screen is a bit hard to see in direct sunlight. Tiny glitches like when you pull the sun visor down, it actually hits against the rear view mirror, which is now electrochromatic, which just seems like a needless thing that could have been picked up in dev. And if you want to change the active safety settings, you have to dig through 100 submenus in the trip computer using the steering wheel buttons every single time you start up because it opts in, which is a real pain in the ass. So a bit like Albor's, I found there are a lot of little fiddly things that might irk you as you lived with the vehicle, but the fundamentals of it are fantastic.
Are there still plenty of buttons on the dash, or is it predominantly all done through the infotainment system?
No, there's still buttons. There's nice rocker switches for the climate control, although I do wish those active safety systems could be controlled via button because it's your prerogative to turn them off if you want, and it'd be nice if it wasn't such a pain to turn them off. So I'd really love to see that. But it's not just screen central. The base LSM, for what it's worth, doesn't have any of the piano black stuff. It's a much more simple interior with a smaller screen, and I actually think I'd kind of prefer that considering the typical user case for a vehicle like this.
So we probably should talk about driving. I don't know whether we mentioned at the beginning what engine powers the MUX.
Yeah, so 140 kilowatt, 450 newton meter, 3 liter diesel. As we spoke about a bit earlier, it's a ripping thing. It's not the quietest. It's a bit agricultural. You still hear quite a bit coming through the firewall, a few decibels louder than a Prado that I recently tested in that regard. The ride quality is good, even on 20s and skinny wheels. It's got a nice loping ride character. The chassis is a lot stiffer than before. The frame is a lot stiffer with more cross members and thicker chassis rails, so it does feel like a more substantial vehicle. And it floats really nicely. You're never quite settled. It's never, you're always sort of moving around a little bit more than you are in an Everest, but by and large, it's a consummate sort of long-range tourer. I did nearly 800 Ks over all manner of surfaces, and honestly, it was a piece of cake. The active safety stuff, it's got a 3D camera and radars. The lane assist system is a bit lazy, not as good as it probably could be, but all the rest of it works relatively well. I didn't have any issues with the active cruise in my test car. And then off-roading as well, it's an absolute beast. And as far as towing is concerned, piece of cake. It'll tow a caravan all day long. Better than most, because that engine has proven itself time and time again. So as far as dynamics are concerned, yeah, really, really good. Right up there with the Aussie engineered Everest, which has long been our benchmark.
Awesome. How did you find the fuel economy?
Yeah, so bang on what it was claimed, actually. Mid-eights every 100 Ks on a mixed loop with an average speed of 40 Ks an hour. And this car was not even run in. It had 82 Ks on it when I picked it up. So it was tight as. And, you know, we've seen with these Isuzus time and again that they're really efficient when towing. And, you know, as far as that goes, it's really good. And the tank is bigger now too. So it's 20% bigger fuel tank at 80 litres. It's not a double tank like the Prado for super long touring, but you can still nudge 1,000 Ks on a full tank, which you certainly couldn't with the old car, which always had a really poxy 65 litre fuel tank. So it's nice to see that's been changed.
What car expert rating did you give it?
I gave it 8.3 out of 10, and I think that's about bang on. I think there are a couple of rough edges to be sorted through, and the price hikes are a little hard to swallow. But, you know, contextually speaking, it's a really strong offering. And, you know, we won't know for sure until we put it in a comparison against all of its direct competitors on the same day. But early impressions are it's every bit as good as the D-Max Ute, which is very good indeed.
I'm assuming you were pretty much agreeing with everything here, Arbols, because you haven't said much.
Well, I mean, I was just shocked when Costello said he's nearly 2 meters tall. I don't think he's really that tall at all. And frankly, I haven't sat in the third row yet, so I couldn't really comment. But my kids generally loved sitting back there, and in fact, they sat there even though the second row was free. So it's certainly been a good hit in the family. I do agree with Mike. It's a great car if you actually need it for the purposes, but I personally would not pick it as a SUV for suburban needs. You know what I mean? Like you really
You'd be mad.
Yeah, it's quite expensive for that, I think. But if you know, if you've got something to tow, if you need to go out in the country every once in a while and actually need proper four-wheel drive capacity, then it's a fantastic thing. And I found its fuel economy to be even better than what it claimed. So mine's like high sevens at the moment. So I'm pretty happy with that. And I don't want to ramble on about this car too much longer, but what's the price difference to the Prado, Mike? Is it actually still significantly cheaper, or has the price increase brought it pretty much in line?
So the top of the range LST at 64 drive away is $2,000 cheaper than a base mine spec GX Prado. And once you start playing with a Prado VX, you're looking at about $90,000, and the Kakadu you're getting bugger all change out of 100. So the price differential's there. In fact, the top of the range MUX costs less than a mid-range Ford Everest, let alone the top of the range one. So it's not the bargain the old one was, and a Mitsubishi Pajero Sport is going to cash in because it is now far and away the cheapest in its class. But it's not an outlier. It's not a ripoff. It's just not quite the bargain the old one was.
Yeah.
All right. We'll wrap it up there. You can search Isuzu MUX at carexpert.com.au. Thank you, Mike.
Pleasure.
Scully, you've spent some time with one of my favourite SUVs on the market at the moment, the Land Rover Defender 90. How important is the all-new Defender 92 Land Rover?
Depends on how you look at it. As a brand-building car and a car to show people that Land Rover is still a serious, you know, serious rival to the Germans and a serious company that knows its roots, it's absolutely essential. Everyone knows what a Defender is, and everyone knows what this Defender is based on a week behind the wheel. In the sales race, I have no idea, to be honest. The 110 has been selling quite strongly. A whole lot of stock arrived last month. but I don't know what the demand is going to be for the 90. It's quite a unique car in that it's sort of BMW X3 size, slightly smaller, but it's a three-door with a tiny boot. So I've got no idea what impact it'll have on the sales charts, but as a brand builder and an image builder for Land Rover, it's absolutely crucial.
Absolutely. What sort of pricing are we looking at for the 90?
So the car that we had on test was the Defender 90 P300, which is a four-cylinder petrol, and it was the S, which is one model up from base. It starts at $83.90 before on-road costs. The cheapest car you can get is just over $70,000, and if you're absolutely loaded, you can pay $135,000 for the P400, which is an inline six in the most aggressive X trim that's got everything off-road on it. Or you can pay just over $200,000 for a V8 when that arrives next year. But realistically, you're looking at between $80,000 and $100,000 for the cars that most people are going to buy.
How good will that V8 be, though? That V8 90. I reckon that's going to be a collectible in the future, personally. I think, although I've been saying this for what feels like forever, that 5-liter engine's got to die at some point, right? although they've got a particulate filter in it now, which really kills the sound, I would love to have that in a 90 Defender. That would make the G-Wagon a little bit scared as you drive past.
It's interesting you say it's killed the sound, because we had the F-Pace SVR through the garage last week, and having not driven one without the particulate filter, it sounded incredible compared to anything else you could buy.
But you got to remember what it used to sound like. you know the main difference is it doesn't crackle anymore.
Right.
So previously, that car in a tunnel, when you lift it off, it was probably one of the most glorious things you could possibly ever hear. And now they did tell me that car is a lot easier to fix that problem with than the other car. So it's not as smart in its computer system. So that's one of those ones you could get the particulate filter removed and you probably won't have too many issues.
Interesting.
Not that I'm endorsing that.
How would you spec your ideal Defender, Scully?
So mine would be, I think it'd have an inline six diesel engine. I like a petrol engine, but I think in a car like the Defender, a relaxed, torquey diesel is the way to go. I think it'd be the 90 on white steel wheels, and I think it'd have a dark blue exterior with a white roof. And then inside, I would go for heated seats. I'd have the normal center console, because you can have it with a six-seat sort of bench in the front, or you can have it with a walkthrough, but I'd just go the normal center console. And there's a few other sort of bits and pieces like the activity key and some of the off-road options. But, yeah, I think blue with white steelies and a white roof is where I'd start.
Absolutely.
Wow, that could not be worse spec.
No,
so
no.
What would you do then, Alboz? Come on.
I'd get the Urban Pack with the 22-inch wheels.
Oh, no.
it would be like a matte grey colour or something really outlandish, and it would have to be the V8, and it would have to be so obvious that it could never go off-road that would make me proud. Like, it would have to struggle to go onto sand. That's how I would spec my Defender.
It would have to be a $150,000 version of your J-Wagon Jimny.
I love that J-Wagon. the looks that people give me brings me so much joy that no amount of therapy would ever repay it.
Do they laugh at it? Is that what they usually do?
It's somewhere between, I can't believe someone would do that too. That looks kind of cool, I think. I hope. Anyway.
Anyway, let's get back to the 90, shall we? What's some of the options that you think definitely needs to be ticked on this car?
So our tester had quite a few options on them. As with anything Land Rover, it really is like ordering off the menu at an American diner or something like that. You can pick and mix absolutely anything. They can do it medium, rare. You always get sides. There's free refills, all of it. Our tester had a folding fabric, like safari-style roof, which was really cool but was also a little bit noisy at highway speeds and in tunnels, so I wouldn't bother with that, and that would save me $5,000.
Wow.
Our tester also had an integrated air compressor in the boot, which you can use if you're out camping or if you're, I don't know, maybe your kids are in a sports team and you want to inflate footballs from the back of your car. $1,500, that's going as well. We had the ClearSight digital rearview mirror in ours, which is really quite cool. You flick a little switch on it and it shows you a camera feed from the top of the car. And when you've got a small car that's got three headrests in the back and then a spare wheel on the boot, it means you can actually see out the back of it. If you load it up to the gills going camping or on the open road, I kind of see the appeal. I think I'd still save that money and not bother with it because, I don't know, I'm just used to driving a long way and not being able to see out the back of the car from my first car. That's a bad habit, I realize, but it took me a while to adjust to the camera. I think in terms of the ones you do want to tick, heavy duty rubber floor mats in a Defender feel essential to me. Every Defender I've driven, the new one, and I've driven a few of the old ones, have had either metal floors or rubber floor mats, and that just makes it a Defender.
Yeah.
I definitely go for the steel wheels. And then there's a whole lot of like terrain response too. There's an active center differential. I think my Defender would have to have all the off-road stuff on it. And I say that as someone who is wearing pristine white shoes that have never seen mud today. I've had them for about 6 months, and they go from my front door to my garage to the office and back. So I'm not an off-road person, but if I was doing it, I think it'd have to be capable of going off-road properly.
Yeah. You are honestly the whitest person I know.
I am, and I freely admit that, but I still would have to have all the off-road stuff on it.
Well, speaking of, did you take it off-road?
So I didn't take it off-road, but Paul did. Okay. We picked up the car on Monday, which was just after lockdown, and we're talking just before lockdown. So
I really shouldn't laugh because I should laugh, but I can't help but you guys that are listening can't see me, but it's hard to hide my smile.
Yeah, the smug smile that Mandy was talking about in the intro from my 911 Turbos album was his lockdown smile. So, yeah, they had it at the Werribee four-wheel drive centre today, but I didn't get the chance to go out and join them. In the review, I've used Paul's feedback and feedback from the video to talk about its off-roading. You have to watch the video for all of it. We've had a couple of Defenders through the office now, and they are incredibly capable. So even the base model we had, which had coil suspension, not air suspension, which means you can't raise and lower it, had more than 290 mils of ground clearance, a 900 millimetre wading depth, and 500 millimetres of wheel articulation. It will go over things with a 38-degree approach angle. It's got a 31-degree breakover angle and a 41-degree departure angle. And what that essentially means is because there's no overhang at the front or the back of the car, you can drive up to really, really steep stuff and the bumpers won't scrape. And once you get to the top, it can be a really pointy sort of peak on the hill and the car won't ground out because it's got quite a short wheelbase. Our experience with the Defender has also shown us that it's just so clever off-road. Everything Land Rover or Range Rover has some degree of off-road smarts, but the Defender takes it to another level again. It's got a whole lot of different terrain modes on it, so you can calibrate the traction control, the throttle response, the transmission to crawl up wet logs or go over rocks and that sort of thing. You can see how deep the water you're wading is on the screen inside. You can look at how locked and unlocked the differentials are. And if you're feeling like you can't quite see, there's even a camera system that shows you what's underneath the front of the car. So it's absolutely loaded with off-road kit. We have done a little bit in a 110 before, and, yeah, Paul found it incredibly capable. This 90 is the same story, but it's got even better angles of attacks and all sorts of things that come from it being a little bit smaller. So I actually had planned to go this weekend and take it to off some off-road courses. My girlfriend and I were going to go on a road trip. That's going to have to wait, unfortunately.
That's a shame. Well, how did it go on-road?
See, this is the part that really surprised me. All of the people that talk about the old Defender as if it's some incredible car to drive clearly have never driven one. It's a shocking car to drive, and I say that with love. I've really enjoyed every single Defender I've driven. I've driven some 90s county models and much older ones on a friend's farm. They're characterful, they're interesting, they're hard work, but they're just shocking to drive, and this one doesn't feel like that. It feels more like a miniature Range Rover on the road, and that's a really big compliment, I think.
Yeah.
On coil springs, I wasn't expecting the ride to be great on the road. I was expecting the air suspension to be an option you absolutely have to tick. But given it's on 18-inch wheels and the coil springs are actually quite soft, it rides really nicely on the open road. It's comfortable and calm in the city. It rides better than most sort of sporty SUVs. And it also doesn't wobble around. You don't have to turn the steering wheel for 19 hours to go around a left turn. You've got good visibility. You can park it easily because it's got cameras. All the stuff that made the old Defender a pain in the ass to drive, this one fixes. The only real problem with it is that it's got quite a strange brake pedal. It feels a bit like an arcade game. And as you push, it's quite sensitive at the top, and as you push harder, it doesn't get any firmer. So if you're not gentle with it, you end up throwing your passengers through the front windscreen. But for the most part, on the road, it's awesome to drive. It's really settled on the highway. It's quiet. I think I'd probably go a diesel over the petrol engine, like I said at the start. although the P400 engine is punchy, it's like a little hot hatch engine. It's got 220 kilowatts and 400 newton meters. It's a little bit noisy when you start it up, and it just doesn't quite have the big, relaxed feel that I would want of a Defender, anyway.
You just complain about a petrol engine being more noisy than a diesel?
It's a different noisy. It's a sort of
Noisy.
It's not a truck. Strange, like it's almost like a Mazda when you start it up. It makes that really high revving buzzy noise. That's not the only reason I wouldn't have it. I think I'd more want the diesel because I just want to be able to lean on the accelerator and have it effortlessly coast around on torque. But yeah, it's just not quite the right engine for that car, I don't think.
Yeah,
it's a shame they haven't got a six cylinder petrol that yet.
The V8's still going to be the one, isn't it? But I think the
P400... Not at that price point. It's too expensive. It's double the price, and I think that's a lot to pay for an extra four cylinders and a supercharger.
How much is it?
It's going to be more than $200,000.
Wow.
The Defender 90 is also available with the P400 inline six engine. So if you really
I thought it was only the 110.
No, so you can get it in the little one as well, which would be a little rocket ship. It's for the equivalent, you can only get it with the higher spec SE. It starts at $95,290. So it's a more expensive car, but it's also a more sophisticated and more powerful engine to go with it.
So Scott, a friend of mine actually took delivery of his 110 quite recently, and I actually got to sit in it. And it's the first time I've actually seen one on the road. And I asked him, he'd been waiting for like 9 months for it. And talking to some dealers here, it feels like that you're not going to get a car anytime soon if you were to order one now.
Jaguar Land Rover's been hit really hard by COVID and by semiconductor shortages. They've got factories in the UK and in Slovakia. And last year, they were two of the hardest hit places. So it has been switching production on and off just as it was meant to be ramping up. In Australia, we've really felt the effects of that because we are a small, irrelevant market to a lot of these brands. So, yeah, some dealers will likely have some stock, but to get the car you want in the exact spec you want, you're going to be waiting. The only thing I can say is it's worth the wait. I'm really, really impressed with it. I think it's a brilliant little car, and it's also not going to be replaced anytime soon. So it's not like you're buying a car that's going to be facelifted with all sorts of new stuff, you know, in the next 12 months, you would certainly hope anyway.
Yeah, and I also heard they're actually taking some features out of the cars you can order now. So some of the more like anything that requires more semiconductors is actually going to go missing with some of these features coming out.
It's something that some brands are doing. I think we've run a story on this about Land Rover. I can't remember off the top of my head, but anything essential safety related, they're going to keep, but there are some extraneous features they've said they're not going to offer. I'm working from memory there. We'll put a link to our story about it in the podcast post, so make sure you check that. A few brands are doing this now. Mercedes has had to do it, BMW as well. Things like extra lumbar support and certain functions that for some reason need another chip in the car are being pulled out because there just aren't enough chips to go around.
What car expert rating did you give it?
So it's an 8.4 out of 10. It scored really, really strongly in ride comfort and fit for purpose. Fuel efficiency, it's a little bit thirsty for what's quite a small petrol engine. Is where it got marked down for the most part. But that's, I think, is possibly the nicest rating I've given a car at Car Expert because it's one of my favorite cars that I've driven. I think it's fantastic. And if I had the cash, I'd buy one like that.
Okay, so you can head to Car Expert to read that review and keep your eyes peeled for the off-road video review with Paul Marrick as well. And that brings a wrap to this week's Car Expert podcast. Zero events and launches happening because three states in Australia are currently in lockdown. Surprise, surprise. So what cars have we got coming up next week, Scully?
So the cars we have in Melbourne are the cars that we have this week, which means that I'm still in the Defender 90, which is not a bad car to be stuck with. We've got a Volkswagen Tiguan 147 TDI Elegance that James is driving and a Land Cruiser Prado that Mike's driving. Up in Sydney, Kurt Dupre is driving a Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross Exceed all-wheel drive. And up in Brisbane, Bors, it's probably best to throw over to you, actually. I don't know what's going on with you guys.
That's a very good question. I also don't know what's going on with our guys. I've been driving this MUX. I've been driving this MUX since the beginning of time, it feels. But actually, you know what? Something we didn't mention, which we're going to have soon, is we did a new M4 versus C63 comparison on track.
Yes.
And that was a hell of a lot of fun that day. I'm not going to tell you who won because that hasn't come out yet. But, yeah, it was fantastic.
It close?
No.
Okay.
It wasn't close. You know what else we're doing? We're doing a Mark 1 Mustang versus a Spec R versus a EcoBoost.
Oh, so that'll be interesting.
It will be amazing. Unfortunately, Chris has all the fun. I provide moral support. So I try and coach him into how to go faster. That seems to be what I do.
Have you guys seen someone has made a GIF of him sliding the WRX?
Yes.
It's fantastic. It's sort of, he rips the handbrake and then you see the STI go side. It's also been edited really well by Igor in the video that's then been turned into the GIF, but it looks so cool. I love watching him drive because he just clearly knows what he's doing.
He makes it look so easy too.
Mm.
Tony's been coaching him daily.
Good old Croft. All right, that's an end. Thank you, Elbows. Thank you, Scully.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Mandy.